League had instituted a playoff bowl in Miami for the runners-up, but Lombardi viewed it largely as an exhibition, a place to experiment by trying defensive backs at wide receiver. The game presented him with a psychological conflict. On the one hand, he believed that you couldn't win the runner-up bowl and call yourself a winner. On the other hand, winning was not a sometime thing. The Packers played to win and beat the Cleveland Browns 40-23. Lombardi later would place the 1963 squad in a special category when he thought back on his career. He'd lost Hornung that year, and then Starr, and then Nitschke. And his friend, the president, was killed, and there was no third consecutive championship, yet the team persisted and nearly prevailed. As far as the Packers are concerned, as someone once said, "We are not slain, just wounded. Let me lay a while and bleed a little, and I will rise to fight again. So will the Packers," Lombardi declared during a speech to the First Friday Club after the season. "While this has been a very frustrating season, for many reasons, this team will always have a soft spot in my heart because of the many adversities and the many frustrations it had to meet. The one big lesson it had to learn, which we all have to learn, is that a team, like men, must be brought to its knees before it can rise again." Paul Hornung, on his knees for a year at the foot of the cross, was on vacation in Miami Beach in early March 1964 when he was summoned to New York again to see Commissioner Rozelle. They met for an hour. Rozelle talked. Hornung mostly listened. Hornung was reminded of the troubles that could result from keeping the wrong company and told to be more careful in the future. At the end of the lecture, Rozelle asked him if he had any questions. "Yes, I have one," Hornung said. "Am I going to be reinstated?" Rozelle declined to answer, but Hornung left the meeting convinced that he would get another chance. 1 week later, on the morning of March 16th, the league office released a 5-paragraph statement announcing that both Hornung and Karras had been reinstated. Headlines throughout the country proclaimed the return of the Golden Boy. Hornung was so eager to return to the field that he called Lombardi and volunteered to report to Green Bay immediately after the Kentucky Derby in early May, 2 months before training camp. He was 10 pounds above his playing weight and wanted to begin a strenuous off-season exercise program under the coach's direction. There had been rumors all year that Lombardi was disillusioned with Hornung. Their father-son bond had been broken by Paul's betrayal, it was said, and Lombardi would remove him from the team for good as soon as possible. Stories circulated about Hornung being traded to Pittsburgh or New York, or being released to play in the AFL. Lombardi had rarely hesitated to rid the team of players he thought would undermine him. Billy Houghton and Howie Ferguson were sent packing when they challenged him before the first training camp. Bill Quinlan was traded after the 1962 championship, when Lombardi concluded that his on-field talents were not worth his erratic off-field behavior. One could argue that Hornung did more to hurt the team than anyone else by behaving so recklessly that he lost a full season of play, but Lombardi didn't view it that way. He was disappointed but not willing to give up on his favorite player. Every time he was asked, he said no. He did not intend to trade Hornung. He wanted him back. And now he said it again. When Hornung told him that he intended to come to Green Bay in early May to start getting in shape, Lombardi revealed how much he still needed him with the eager reply, "Mid-April would be better." And so they compromised, as Hornung later joked, and the Golden Boy reported in mid-April. Bart Starr and Boyd Dowler were in Green Bay that spring and worked out with Hornung. They ran wind sprints, 4 at 100 yards and then 4 at 50 yards over and over. Then Hornung alone jogged up the stadium steps again and again. "There are 60 steps, in case you're interested. I've counted them a few times," he told Dick Young, the sports columnist, for the New York Daily News. I think I'm in great shape. I pulled a groin muscle the other day, but that's nothing. What's important is that my right knee, the one I hurt in 62, was given a year's rest. It feels better than ever. I want to have a great year. No sooner did Lombardi welcome back his prodigal son than he sent another of his key players away, trading Jim Ringo and fullback Earl Groh to the Philadelphia Eagles for linebacker Leroy Caffey and a first-round draft choice. The manner of Ringo's departure later became one of the familiar fables of the Lombardi mythology, as the story would be told through the years. Ringo visited Lombardi's office that spring, seeking a substantial raise. And to help negotiate, he brought along a newfangled creature in the sporting world, a player agent. Ringo had been a Green Bay stalwart, a perennial all-pro who hadn't missed a game in 10 seasons, captain of the offense, smart and swift, his blocking agility essential to the success of their signature play, the Packers sweep. Lombardi knew all of that and admired Ringo, but was insulted by the presence of the agent. He couldn't tolerate anything or anyone getting between him and his players, making the process seem mercenary, less personal. The presence of an agent made it harder for him to get up from his desk and rub the player's head and get him to relent, as he'd done with Bob Skoronski. It interfered with his concept of team, the subordination of individual desire for the greater good of the group. And so, as the story went, when Ringo and his agent demanded a raise, Lombardi excused himself, went into the next room, and returned a few minutes later saying, "Go talk to the Eagles about it. Mr. Ringo has been traded to Philadelphia." The story became ever more popular in later years when agents emerged as central figures in the sports world and the public grew increasingly disillusioned with multimillionaire athletes. Lombardi never would have put up with that stuff. Remember what he did to Ringo. Traded him as soon as he walked in with an agent. But it did not happen that way. Ringo did have an agent that year, and he demanded a $25,000 salary, but the negotiating was done with Pat Pepler, the personnel director, not Lombardi. And both the player and coach had other motives. Ringo was interested in moving back to the Philadelphia area, his home. Lombardi had spent weeks studying his team's strengths and weaknesses and concluded that Ringo was slowing down and that he needed another young linebacker and more draft choices. He used the Eagles' pick to draft Donnie Anderson, the running back from Texas Tech, who wouldn't be eligible to play professionally for another year. It was not an impulsive act, but a carefully calculated maneuver. Vince had been thinking about this and working on it quietly for a long time, Pepler recalled. Most of the story wasn't true. It was all done on the telephone. It did happen suddenly enough, however, that Lombardi had to scramble for a center. Within minutes of trading Ringo, Lombardi was in the locker room with Bob Skoronski, working him on the snap, knowing that he would have to use his left tackle at center until an untested rookie came along. The apocryphal story of Ringo's quick exit was perpetuated largely because Lombardi wanted it to be believed. Rather than correct the tale, he spread it himself, Pepler said, in the hope that it might discourage players from hiring agents or making difficult contract demands. His bark, for the most part, was worse than his bite. And like all general managers, Lombardi, out of necessity, found himself dealing with agents and lawyers during the latter half of the 60s. If there was anything in Lombardi's life that approached his obsession with football during his time in Green Bay, it was golf. He attended Mass every morning out of a combination of habit and spiritual need, but he would have played golf 365 days a year if it had been possible, wholly out of love. He kept several of his gift putters at work, and at odd hours dropped a few balls on the floor and practiced putting them at one of those light aluminum golf hole contraptions with the clinking hinges. Marie often caught him doing the same at home, lagging balls at a plastic tumbler. The golf season was cruelly short in northeastern Wisconsin, but he and his cronies hit the Oneida links at the first sign of survivable weather. He and Ray Antle once played 2 days after Christmas, wearing long underwear and warmers and flap-eared hats, although the club didn't officially open until April 1st. "My father's life was golf," Susan reflected. "He loved golf. My mother hated to go to some vacation spots like Bermuda and Puerto Rico and the Bahamas with him because she knew he just wanted to golf." His off-season schedule was arranged around golf opportunities. First, there was a late winter trip with Marie, but not Susan, who spent most of her teens home alone with a babysitter on her birthday, February 13th. That trip often coincided with a league meeting set in a warm, golf course-rich locale. Then came a stag holiday with Harry Mass, Aki Kruger, and Jack Kepler, a four-day southern swing every March to Gulfport, Biloxi, and New Orleans, or once Hot Springs. Lombardi fed his golfing addiction by insisting that they play on the afternoon they arrived and the morning they left, and gambling was fit into the trip as well. Kruger's lasting memory is of Lombardi heading straight for the craps table, the game he'd learned long ago from his Izzo uncles on the green felt of the pool table in the basement at the family homestead in Sheepshead Bay. He'd sit at the craps table, and Christ! Everyone stopped in the casino because he was making so much noise, shouting, "Come on, come on!" Kruger recalled. Marie tolerated that trip, barely, rationalizing that her husband needed it to relieve the stress, but she always held it against Kepler for taking her husband away from her. Finally, there was a two-day outing in May in which the Green Bay coaches played against their counterparts from Detroit and Cleveland, rotating cities and country clubs every year. From April through the opening of training camp in mid-July, Lombardi golfed three or four times a week, including Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, a welcome relief for his overworked assistants, who would create a traffic jam on the steps getting out of the office as soon as Lombardi left, according to Pat Pepler. Lombardi reduced his trips to the golf course once the football season began, but continued playing, slipping out to Oneida after the morning practice on Saturdays when the team was at home the next day. "It was a form of relaxation for him," said team physician Eugene Brusky, perhaps Oneida's longest driver. If Lombardi relaxed on the course, his body language failed to show it. There was nothing graceful about his game. He had a bulky frame with little suppleness. His swing was stiff and jerky, and he had a short follow-through, the golfing equivalent, perhaps, of Jerry Kramer's place-kicking. "He looked ugly out there," said Max McGee, who played with him occasionally on Mondays when the players were allowed on Oneida. "You'd play around with him and think he'd shot 110. But in fact, he was far better. Bob Millward, the pro at Oneida, who gave Lombardi lessons, called him a pretty straight shooter, whose average was in the mid-80s. It seemed that Lombardi willed the ball, or sought to intimidate it, into the cup. "He was an intense competitor," said Kepler, a regular in Lombardi's foursome. Kepler, who carried a 3-handicap 10 strokes better than Lombardi, enjoyed being the coach's partner in best ball contests, where a team played the superior shot hit by either player. "It was amazing how well he could play if I happened to miss a shot. If I was playing well, he would just play along. But if I happened to knock it somewhere not as good as it should be, he could just focus on making that thing do what he wanted it to do. Some guys go the other way. When playing with a low handicap player and that guy gets stuck somewhere, they get it stuck worse. Vince may hit only 3 or 4 good shots around, but they were the ones that saved us. Of course, we would win quite a few matches before they started. The other team would be three or four down before they got over the fact that they were playing against Vince Lombardi. When Lombardi was playing golf, it rarely could be kept secret. He brought his booming voice and volcanic temper with him. "You could hear him anywhere on the course when he missed a shot," said Tom Hallion, who occasionally caddied for him at Oneida. "It was very R-rated and guttural. God damn it, son of a bitch." Several Oneida golfers would later tell variations of a story of Lombardi furiously tossing his putter into Duck Creek as he walked across the bridge at the fourth hole. Bob Maas, another teenage caddy at Oneida during that era, said he was carrying Lombardi's bags one day when the foursome got stuck behind a group of slow-playing women, including the wife of the owner of Nicolette Sporting Goods. He would scream obscenities and hit the ball. He was hitting when she was marking her scorecard on the green, Maas said. Everyone was afraid of him. Once Lombardi got back in the clubhouse, the young caddy noticed. He was all smiles and grins, just like you would see on TV. His whole personality would change. If golf was a needed outlet for Lombardi, a place to smack a ball around and curse and hang out with his cronies, it also revealed a deeper insight into his personality as a leader. He once told Mitch Fromstein, a Milwaukee businessman, that the toughest single battle he had in life was his golf game. Fromstein thought he was joking, but Vince said, "I'm going to tell you why. Because I have the toughest opponent in my golf game. Me. I'm trying to improve my score, and it's just me. I'm always fighting to get better against myself. That's tough." Lombardi understood that he was not the perfect vessel for the sporting life. He was short, stocky, slow, colorblind, awkward, injury-prone, and emotional. He could not excel at any athletic endeavor that depended on his own primary skills, whether it was running or blocking or hitting a baseball or shooting a basketball or craps or playing hands of gin or rounds of golf. All were difficult for him. He could make himself better, but never the best. But he had a sharp mind, keen memory, and overpowering will. He knew what perfection looked like and what was required to approach it. All he needed was the material with which to work. In football, as a coach, he had it. In the arm of Bart Starr, the agility of Willie Wood, the fluid grace of Paul Hornung and Herb Adderley, the muscled abandon of Jimmy Taylor and Ray Nitschke, the rugged perseverance of Forrest Gregg and Henry Jordan, the savvy of his captains, Bob Skoronski and Willie Davis. They provided the talent that he lacked. He provided the will and the way, pushing them to levels of performance that he knew were possible for them, but that he could never attain himself, closing the gap between the hugeness of his desire and the smallness of reality. On the first day of 1964 training camp, Paul Hornung unpacked his suitcase on the brown blanketed bed in room 120 at Sensenbrenner Hall at St. Norbert College. It was the same compact dorm room that he used to stay in, with the same old wisecracking roommate. "I don't know if I should be rooming with you," Max McGee said upon greeting him. "I'm not supposed to associate with gamblers." The Golden Boy's comeback had begun, and it seemed as though half the sports journalists in America were on hand to chronicle it. Articles on Hornung were commissioned by magazines ranging from Sports Illustrated to Parade. Sport ran two pieces, one by Dick Schaap and another by New York Journal-American writer Dave Anderson. "His name isn't Paul Hornung this season. It's Paul Hornung returning from a suspension for gambling," Anderson began. W.C. Hines also wrote a piece for Life while he was back in town to ease the way for the production of a television documentary version of Run to Daylight. The documentary borrowed the name of the book more than the dramatic concept. It did not follow the coach's life hour by hour and day by day through a week leading up to a game. but rather took the viewer on a tour of training camp, beginning with a juxtaposition of the profane and divine. Dark and chaotic frames of violent contact at the line of scrimmage, followed by a bright and bucolic scene of Lombardi strolling down the sidewalk outside Sensenbrenner Hall on a July morning, birds chirping, sun shining through the trees, the first day of camp. "Good morning, sisters," he says cheerily as he encounters two young nuns walking in the other direction. "Good afternoon, Mr. Lombardi," they respond in unison. "It's nice," he has stepped on their lines. "Nice to see you back," they go on. "Well, thank you. It's nice to be back here at St. Norbert. It's a beautiful day, too, by the way, isn't it?" There are scenes of Hog Hanner driving to camp from Arkansas in his pickup truck, of Willie Davis and Ray Nitschke toting a football as they lumber down the practice field in wind sprints, of a quartet of rookies singing an earnest, if painful, version of Hello, Dolly for the veterans in an after-dinner ritual, of Jimmy Taylor talking about how football is a contact sport and how much he and his coach love contact. There are two interviews with right guard Jerry Kramer, whose accounts of the inner game reveal an honest and articulate sensibility that will be put to profitable use years later in his own books, and a multitude of scenes involving Hornung, the man of the hour, sipping soup, stepping on the scale, running the stadium steps, gliding behind Jerry and Fuzzy on the sweep, talking into the camera about getting in shape, reminiscing on the fears he felt as a rookie, and to some extent was feeling again now, hoping that the other players would accept him as a football player and as a man. And finally, in the last frame of the film, the horn steps toward the ball and kicks a field goal straight and true. Lombardi is the film's main character. In many scenes, he seems painfully conscious of the camera and microphone recording him for posterity. Even when he's stationed at his favorite practice field post, riding on the back of the blocking sled, imploring his troops to hit harder and drive him farther, there's a sense that he is not so much an obsessed coach lost in work as Lombardi trying to play Lombardi. Perhaps the camera captured something that otherwise would have gone undetected. There was always an element of performance in his coaching routine. Through the years, several of his assistants and his son Vincent at various times entered his dressing quarters and found him in unguarded moments standing in front of the mirror rehearsing the facial expressions. Sober, grimacing, intense, inspiring, that he would use minutes later in the locker room as he exhorted his players. The most authentic Lombardi moment was also the most planned, though scripted by him, not the producers. Every year on the opening Sunday night of training camp, he delivered a speech to the players in which he defined what it meant to be a member of the Green Bay Packers. Lombardi is standing behind a lectern. His players are seated at classroom desks in the lecture hall, some taking notes, all appearing to give him their undivided attention. The theme of his oration is pride and how much it matters. "I'd like to welcome you all, of course, and tell you how proud we are to have you as part of the Packers, just as you should be proud to be here with this team," Lombardi begins. "Now, one thing about the Packers, it's a team with a great tradition, a great and wonderful tradition. And that tradition, or that whatever you want to call it, that glory that is the Packers, has been developed from one thing only, and that's pride. Everybody has ability, but pride and performance is what makes the difference. Now, how do you develop pride? Pride is developed from a winning tradition." While Lombardi's speech is timeless, the documentary as a whole, which ran for an hour on prime time on ABC, did not transcend its time and place, although it got good reviews. From the remove of decades, it has the feel of a quaint period piece, an innocent narrative set to tinkly music, produced before the era of quick-cut action accompanied by jazz riffs and slow-motion montages set to uplifting pop ballads. But it holds a special place in the Lombardi mythology for several reasons. It introduced him to a larger television audience beyond those who watched the Packers on autumn Sunday afternoons, and it also marked his first association with Howard Cosell, who was beginning his rise as the dominant mythmaker of the modern television sports era. Cosell's nasal voice was nowhere to be heard, his declarative ego not yet fully unleashed in front of the camera. The narrator was Horace McMahon, whose deep, rumbling delivery bore a haunting similarity to Lombardi's, and who was best known for his iconic introduction to the popular television show There Are 7 Million Stories in the Naked City. Lou Volpicelli was the director, and Cosell, who'd read Run to Daylight and considered Hines a great writer, produced the show in partnership with ABC, putting up half the money. Cosell and Lombardi had been casual acquaintances for decades. Each grew up in Brooklyn and attended college in New York, Lombardi at Fordham and Cosell at NYU. Cosell followed Lombardi's rise from West Point to the Giants to Green Bay with increasing interest. He admired Lombardi's straightforward style, his will to win, and his ability as a leader to see beyond race, class, and culture, to build a loyal and dependable team out of disparate characters. While others viewed Lombardi as the archetypal opposite of another Cosell favorite, the young boxer Cassius Clay, one symbolizing authority, the other freedom, Cosell saw them as singular personalities with compelling stories. What Lombardi thought of Cosell is less clear. According to Hines, the coach was not enthralled by the prospect of having the sportscaster lurking around training camp that summer. "He said Cosell was a pain in the neck," according to Hines. "I said, come on, coach, he's putting up half the money. This is a good thing. It's good for you. It's good for the Packers. It's good for football." Lombardi was playing golf in Neenah the day that Cosell arrived. He'd lent his Pontiac to Hines, who picked up Cosell at the airport and drove him to meet the coach. "Listen, tread lightly with Vince," Hines warned, fearing that Cosell's overbearing nature might antagonize the overbearing coach. I know," Cosell said. Lombardi was sitting in the clubhouse in Neenah, and when he saw Cosell, he shouted, "How are you, coach?" Cosell was struck dumb. "He called me coach," he whispered excitedly to Hines. Cosell thought it was a sign of intimacy. Coach was Cosell's own nickname for himself. "Raymond," Cosell could be heard announcing to the bartender at Les Artistes, his hangout near the ABC studios in Manhattan, "keep the martini chilled for the coach. I'll be back in 10 minutes. Hines didn't feel like telling Cosell that Lombardi was indiscriminate with the nickname. To him, everyone and anyone might be coach. 2 days later, Hines entered Lombardi's office and found the real coach in a foul mood. "Out!" Lombardi growled. "What?" "You know who. Cosell. I don't want him around anymore." "He's going home tonight, coach. Relax," Hines said. Cosell had been asking questions non-stop, propounding his own theories on football, beating Lombardi at gin, using words that Lombardi only vaguely knew, exhibiting no apparent fear of the coach, showing an ego just as large. Cosell might have thought he was bonding, but Lombardi considered it too much. The story went around the locker room that Cosell once said to Lombardi, "Coach, how many great sportscasters do you think there are?" And Lombardi responded, "One less than you think, Howard." It sounded unlikely. Lombardi rarely displayed such wit. But it might have accurately expressed his exasperation with his fellow New Yorker. You had to play Lombardi carefully. Don't interrupt him and push him too far at any time, Hines said. Howard was always so aggressive. But he was a great reporter, you've got to give him that, a great reporter. And from then on, Cosell considered himself the coach's close friend and the world's leading expert on the genius of the great Vince Lombardi. Much was at stake in the season opener in Green Bay. It was not only Hornung's first game since 1962, but also an opportunity for the Packers to gain revenge against the world champion Bears. None of that seemed to faze the Golden Boy, who remained easygoing in the days leading up to the game. He declared himself in the best condition of his life, down to 212 pounds, and ready for a season that would make everyone forget about his forced year off. After practice on Friday, he picked up his mother at the airport, then drove over to the Northland for a haircut. Lombardi was already there, and they took their trims two chairs apart. Just having Hornung in the lineup reassured the coach. He'd felt better since the first intra-squad game, when Hornung made his patented cutback on the sweep and found his way to the end zone. "Hornung's back! Hornung's back! The Golden Boy is back!" Lombardi had yelled on the sidelines that day. Now he was silent, dozing in the barber's chair, and soon enough, so was his halfback, like father, like son. "You put on the clippers, and he goes to sleep," the barber explained to Tex Moll, who was spending the week with his favorite team. As Sunday broke, bright and cool, there was a sense in Green Bay that everything was right with the world, restored to the way it was supposed to be. Lombardi had his boy back and played him for nearly the entire game. Hornung remained on the field for all but two offensive plays, completing an option pass, kicking three field goals, and gaining 77 yards on 15 carries, including one classic Packer sweep, the horn gliding to the right, then cutting back sharply and loping downfield for 40 yards. As if to show off the renewed dynamism of the Lombardi-Hornung partnership, the coach drew on his daring and rulebook expertise to send Hornung in for a rare free-kick 52-yard field goal with 8 seconds remaining in the first half. Elijah Pitts had received a punt near midfield with a fair catch, which, according to an obscure rule, allowed the Packers to place the ball on the line of scrimmage for an uncontested free-kick field goal. Hornung's boot was low and unpretty, but with no Bears rushing in for the block, it sailed over the crossbar. Green Bay won 23-12, and Maul had the headline he wanted. Shining hour for Golden Boy. It was, as it turned out, the last shining hour of the season for Hornung, Lombardi, and the Packers. Jerry Kramer played in the opener, despite a piercing pain in his abdomen, and that was the last time he suited up all year. Doctors feared that he might be suffering from life-threatening cancer, until they belatedly discovered that he'd been infected by a 7.5-inch sliver of wood that had been lodged in his body undetected for years, going back to an incident in his Idaho teens when he was chasing a calf and slammed into a fence post. With Ringo traded and Kramer out, Lombardi's offensive line, the key to his running attack, was not the same. Kramer was missed even more in another way. The difference between winning and losing that season was so narrow that the major problem turned out to be the inaccuracy of Hornung's toe and the unavailability of Kramer to replace him as the kicker. The Packers lost the second game of the year to the eventual conference champions, the Baltimore Colts, 21-20, and the difference in the game was a missed Hornung extra point. In the fourth game, the Vikings blocked an extra point that proved decisive in a 24-23 Green Bay loss. In the sixth game, Hornung missed four field goals and had another blocked as the Packers lost to the Colts for the second time, 24-21. Green Bay outgained its opponents all year and played vigorous defense, but won 8 games, lost 5, and tied 1, as Hornung missed 26 of 38 field goal attempts. It was a measure of the respect with which he was held by his teammates and coach that they refused to blame him for another second-place season. Lombardi said he might have put Kramer in to kick if he'd been available, but always believed that Hornung would regain his rhythm. He likened Hornung's kicking woes to a 300 hitter who gets in a slump, except we can't bench him. For the second straight year, Lombardi took his team to the playoff bowl in Miami, but this time he did not even feign interest in the game against the St. Louis Cardinals. In private meetings with his squad, he disparaged the whole notion of such a game. He called it the shit bowl, according to Bob Skowronski. That's the word he used. He said it was a loser's bowl for losers. The Packers lost to the Cardinals, and afterwards Lombardi fumed about a hinky-dink football game held in a hinky-dink town played by hinky-dink players. That's all second place is, hinky-dink. He said that he would never come back and had no intention of ever finishing second again. It was an uncertain time for Lombardi, the most confusing period for him since he'd reached Green Bay. He'd thought about leaving the year before, when the 49ers made a covert inquiry, and then the AFL's Jets presented him with a lucrative offer to return to New York. But none of that had worked out. Olenichik and the league would not let him go, nor would his pride. He wanted those 3 in a row, so he'd stayed and appeared committed to Green Bay for several more seasons. 2 years of losing, or not winning, had taken a toll, and Sunset Circle was a particularly depressed place after the season. Mr. High-Low was low, and his wife was lower, as the long Green Bay winter continued through the first months of 1965. The dark, dreary days, the agitated condition of her husband, her own psychological need to be the center of attention, all apparently combined to send Marie into a depression. On the afternoon of February 12th, she apparently drank too much, swallowed too many prescription pills intended for headaches and depression, and passed out in bed. Susan found her holding a bottle of pills in her hand. It was not the first time. Susan yelled to her father, who came into the room and shook Marie awake. They drove her to St. Vincent Hospital, where she was watched overnight. Her depression and pleas for help were obvious, but the family did its best to avoid the subject. Susan said that she and her father acted as though Marie had a bout with the flu. Vincent, coincidentally, arrived from St. Paul the next day, unaware of the trouble, and was looking forward to celebrating the most joyous event of his life. He had proposed to his girlfriend, Jill Butts, a senior at the College of St. Catherine, and was bringing her home so that they could both tell the family. They arrived at Sunset Circle, only to discover that everyone was at the hospital. Marie was recovering by then, but news of her son's engagement did not cheer her up. Jill showed her the engagement ring, which did not satisfy Marie. Perhaps nothing could, then. The ring was a band of sapphires, not a diamond, and not big enough, Marie complained. That night, Vince and Susan, Vincent and Jill went to dinner, leaving Marie at the hospital. It was also Susan's 18th birthday, an event nearly lost in the commotion. There was no mention of Marie's illness at the restaurant. Lombardi tried to act festive for his children, but appeared distracted. He spent much of the time talking about a new high-protein diet that Marie had put him on, limiting his carbohydrate intake. Steak and salad, no bread. For Vincent, here was another bittersweet instance when he and his dad were not quite connecting. He was announcing his engagement and his father was going on about a new diet. The problem was not an absence of love. Love was there. The problem was how to show it. There was the time in Vincent's junior year when the Packers were playing in Minnesota, and Lombardi made a rare appearance at a St. Thomas football game. Vincent ran for 64 yards and scored 2 touchdowns against Gustavus Adolphus. And the only thing the father said to his proud son after the game was that he should lift his feet up higher when he ran. Or the time in his freshman year when he hurt his knee and was limping around, not playing, feeling sorry for himself. The Packers were in town, so he went over to the hotel to visit his father. I walk in the lobby, and there are a lot of players there, and they're all saying, "That's too bad." Lots of sympathy and pats on the back, Vincent said later. I go up to Dad's suite, and he says, "Come in here," and he's got Dr. Nellen there, who looks at it and says it's loose, but there's nothing serious. And Dad lights into me, just rips me up one side and down the other. "You're going to be running on that tomorrow," he says. Vincent left the hotel with tears running down his cheeks, certain that his father did not understand him. 2 weeks later, he was starting. The old man had been right, and perhaps he'd acted out of love, but it came out in uncomfortable ways. For the most part, Lombardi's transference of ambition had been to his players, not his son, and perhaps that was lucky. Otherwise, the pressure might have been wholly intolerable. With 38 other young men to work with every day, Lombardi didn't need so much to live through his son, to try to attain success through his son and ruin his son, like Willie Loman and his son Biff in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Lombardi was the successful salesman that Loman could never be, but there nonetheless are faint echoes of Willie and Biff in the frustrating scenes between Vince and Vincent. "When you hit, hit low and hit hard, because it's important, boy," Willie says to Biff in a dream sequence near the end of the play. They're on a football field, and it's a final, yearning, plaintive, empty offering of advice on how to succeed and win in modern America. "Lift your legs up when you run," Vince said to Vincent, and the meaning was almost the same. The wedding was scheduled for June 26th in Minot, North Dakota, Jill's hometown. Marie arrived 3 days early for a series of luncheons and a society page interview with the Minot Daily News. Vince flew in through a summer squall in time to play golf with the Butts brothers and the club pro at Minot Country Club the morning before the wedding. At the rehearsal dinner that night, Vince and Marie received word that one of their old friends, Jack Mara, who ran the Giants with brother Wellington, was dying of colon cancer at age 57. Marie dabbed at tears the rest of the night. When asked why she was crying, she said it was for Jack. The wedding was held at noon the next day, a grand social event, drawing more than 400 people to the Church of the Little Flower, many of them awestruck at the sight of the famous father of the groom. After a reception at the country club, dinner was offered at the Butts house. The gathering spread out from the patio onto their spacious back lawn. The rains came before dusk, and as guests traipsed inside the house, their soiled footprints blackened Mrs. Butts's white carpeting. After Vincent and Jill left for their honeymoon, Marie found a seat on the front porch and sat motionless for hours, rarely speaking, lost in the darkness of the northern plains, sobbing softly late into the night. She was confronting the same emotion that her husband had been facing in a very different realm. The unbearable pain of coming in second again. Chapter 21. Winning Isn't Everything. The compulsion to win, Bertolt Brecht once wrote, is the black addiction of the brain. The Marxist playwright and the Jesuit football coach were philosophical opposites. But on this matter, they were not far apart, and there's no doubt that Lombardi had the addiction by 1965. After coming in second 2 years in a row, he vowed never to lose again and redoubled his efforts to assure that he would not. He papered the locker room walls with motivational aphorisms, all variations on the themes of competition and success. One of those maxims later came to be regarded as the essence of his philosophy. Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. What exactly he meant by that, indeed whether he believed it or even said it, has been a matter of debate ever since. His critics blamed Lombardi for promoting a win-at-all-cost competitive pathology that led inevitably to Richard Nixon's dirty tricksters at the Committee to Re-elect the President, whose 1972 headquarters featured a sign that read, "Winning in politics isn't everything, it's the only thing." Lombardi's supporters insisted through the years that he was misinterpreted. What he said, or meant to say, they claimed, was that winning isn't everything, it's the only thing worth striving for, or winning isn't everything, but making the effort to win is. His philosophy of winning was more complex and contradictory than either side would allow. The precise words, "winning isn't everything, it's the only thing," were indisputably part of the Lombardi phrasebook and did appear in bold letters once on the locker room wall. But to say that he believed them is true, yet meaningless out of context. Every year, Lombardi told his players that professional football was a cruel business. His job, and theirs, he would say, depended on only one thing, winning. And the only way to win was to accept nothing less. To that extent, his statement was an articulation of the obvious, the reality faced by any professional athlete or coach, and not necessarily relevant in a broader sense. But to say that winning was merely a practical necessity for Lombardi would be misleading. He considered it a matter of personal as well as national definition. "The American zeal," he once called it. "That is to be first in what we do and to win, to win, to win." He was obsessed with winning, and that obsession led to unfortunate imbalances in other aspects of his life. Still, there was a crucial distinction in his philosophy between paying the price to win and winning at any price. He didn't believe in cheating to win, and he showed no interest in winning the wrong way without heart, brains, and sportsmanship. Although he never shied away from the violence of the game, insisting that football was not a contact sport but a collision sport, he did not encourage dirty play. Piling on, cheap shots, clotheslining people, that wasn't our style of play. Said Tom Brown, the former baseball player who took over as strong safety in the mid-60s. When one of Lombardi's defensive backs tripped a receiver in frustration, he immediately yanked him from the game, even though the referees didn't see the violation. Winning in and of itself was not enough for him. His players knew that he was more likely to drive them mercilessly after they'd played sloppily but won than when they had played hard but lost. After games, Henry Jordan would always get this look on his face and say, "Who won?" "Because we always won, but you wouldn't know it from Vince," said Red Cochran. Vince would be chewing everybody out. He would be most like what everyone probably thought of Lombardi, a tyrant, more volatile, after a close win where we screwed up, than any other time. Carroll Dale, a receiver who came to the Packers in 1965 from Los Angeles, said that it was human nature, when you win, to overlook mistakes. But Lombardi was different. He would not overlook them. He would correct them immediately. Winning wasn't everything for him. He wanted excellence. There's a difference. For years afterwards, his players spoke with amazement at the recollection of Lombardi's behavior after an exhibition game they'd played in Jacksonville against St. Louis. The Packers thoroughly whipped the Cardinals that day, 41-14. After the final gun, Bob Skowronski was strolling casually back to the dressing room, talking to some friends who'd come down for the game. Suddenly the door opened, and an assistant coach grabbed me and said, "You better get in here." And I walked in, and there was Coach Lombardi, standing on a chair, screaming at the top of his lungs. I thought I was in the wrong locker room. I thought we'd won. He was furious with the way they had played in the second half. Winning was not enough. The signature phrase itself, "winning isn't everything, it's the only thing," was not coined by Lombardi, and in fact, the first time it was recorded for posterity, it was uttered not by Lombardi or by any other football coach, but by an 11-year-old actress. Its etymology goes back decades before the philosopher coach reached his rhetorical apogee in Green Bay in the mid-1960s. But the best place to start is in Hollywood in 1953 with the screenwriter Melville Shavelson. Warner Brothers had optioned a piece of short fiction from the Saturday Evening Post about a football coach at a small Catholic college and recruited Shavelson to write the screenplay, which he agreed to do after also being made producer. He sent the script to John Wayne, who surprised everyone by taking the starring role, even though, as Shavelson said, the football coach didn't ride a horse or shoot a gun. The script became the movie, Trouble Along the Way, which was a box office flop and quickly assigned to the dustiest bins of celluloid obscurity, yet takes on a rich subtext when viewed in parallel with the life and mythology of Vince Lombardi. The story involves a fictional college in New York named St. Anthony's, which bears a certain resemblance to Fordham. The school has fallen into debt and is to be closed by the diocese. But the old rector, Father Burke, is determined to save it. His scheme to stay afloat is to create a big-time football team that can draw sell-out crowds at the polo grounds. In search of someone to resurrect the program, he finds Steve Williams, the John Wayne character, a winning coach with a checkered past who has lost jobs in several conferences already. Steve also happens to be a down-on-his-luck father. He lives above a pool hall with his tomboy daughter, Carol, who calls him Steve, and knows how to cure his hangovers and loves football as much as he does. Her mother, Steve's ex-wife, has run off with a Manhattan dandy. Miss Singleton, a social worker played by Donna Reed, comes in to examine the home life of young Carol, and is almost deceived by the manipulative ex-wife into believing that Steve should lose parental rights, but eventually falls in love with him, despite his outrageously sexist behavior, and also becomes best pals with his daughter. Steve, in the meantime, goes about the business of bringing winning football to St. Anthony's. At first he seems like no one more than Vince Lombardi when he replaced the hapless Scooter McLean in Green Bay. "We gotta get back to fundamentals," Steve says, swaggering cockily around the practice field in sweatpants and a letter jacket, exhorting his players to hit him, teaching them by example how to block and tackle. But soon enough he's doing whatever it takes to win. He recruits a quarterback from the Canadian Professional League, brings in more ringers by promising them a share of concession and gate receipts, and holds workouts all summer in violation of collegiate rules. His schemes, as Shavelson lets them unfold, come in the context of society's larger hypocrisy. Why shouldn't his players get the money instead of some rich alumni? Steve asks at one point. He exacts free equipment from a sporting goods store by reminding the salesman of kickbacks he'd taken in the past and forces the polo grounds to book St. Anthony's by threatening to organize a religious protest against the professional contests held there every Sunday. Before the opening game of the year, Steve's ringers show up at Mass wearing their letter jackets and pray for victory. The crowd at the polo grounds is standing room only. Father Burke is there amidst a covey of giddy religious fathers who suddenly worship football. Miss Singleton and Carol arrive at half-time after escaping a hideous society party for rich young people at Carol's mother's penthouse suite, a phony event that contrasts sharply with the vigor of football. And a huge upset is in the offing. St. Anthony's is ahead 13-0. Carol chomps on a hot dog, delighted with her father's success. But the virtuous social worker seems concerned. She has learned about Steve's illegal recruiting methods. Carol wonders why she isn't cheering. "I'm not getting paid," Miss Singleton says. Then she asks, "Is winning so important?" And from the mouth of an 11-year-old girl comes the immortal answer. "Listen," she responds. "Like Steve says, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing." In the end, of course, it's neither everything nor the only thing. Father Burke learns about Steve's underhanded methods and temporarily suspends the football program. Then he decides that Steve was just doing what he knew how to do, and that it was his own desperation to save the school that led to trouble. He brings Steve back on better terms, and the final scene shows Steve, Miss Singleton, and Carol, hand in hand, leaving church. The drama behind the scenes surpassed anything on the set. Wayne, the symbol of American manhood, was cheating on his second wife, and had brought his latest lover, Pilar, who would later become his third wife, to Hollywood to be with him during the filming. His second wife had hired a detective, however, so Wayne occasionally disappeared, once for a week, trying to lose the gumshoe's tail. When he was on the set, he demanded that in every scene with Donna Reed, she had to make a play for him. Machismo wasn't everything. It was the only thing. This would have ruined the Miss Singleton character, so Shavelson pretended to adhere to Wayne's wishes, then reshot many of the scenes without him to restore them to their original intent. It was from this milieu of Hollywood mythology and deceit that Lombardi's trademark phrase arose. Shavelson had only a passing knowledge of football when he wrote the script. Decades earlier, he'd covered the sport 1 year for the student newspaper at Cornell, from which he'd graduated in 1937, making him a contemporary of Lombardi, who was playing guard at Fordham during that same era. In contrast to the formidable Fordham team of the seven blocks of granite, Cornell stumbled through the season without winning a game. But Shavelson saw enough to develop what he later called a troubled take on football, aware that a hell of a lot of players on other teams were too big and driving big cars, and something was wrong. The coach at Cornell then was Gil Doby, known as Gloomy Gil, who once warned Shavelson never to bet on college football games because of their unpredictability. "The outcome depends on whether the quarterback got laid last night." As to the famous phrase, Shavelson said it came from his Hollywood agent, who also happened to represent the colorful UCLA football coach, Henry Red Sanders. "The agent quoted me the line once and said that he had heard Sanders say it," Shavelson recalled. "That's how it got in the script." If Red Sanders coined the phrase, as it appears he did, it would be appropriate. Before heading for UCLA on the West Coast in 1949, Sanders had been at Vanderbilt. He was the best friend of the most revered sports writer in Nashville, Fred Russell of the Nashville Banner, and by extension also close to Russell's mentor, Grantlin Rice, who'd gone on from Vanderbilt in Nashville to become the great mythmaker of sports in New York. Herb Rich, who played for Sanders at Vanderbilt and for Lombardi in New York, said they were equally intimidating. "Sanders," he said, "was one of those coaches who, if he walked by, you would start jogging in place just to show that you were active. He had a cutting tongue, and we feared him." His cutting tongue meant something different to the press. He was known for his sardonic wit and frequent use of sayings. Sometimes he would throw out a series of clichés just to exasperate the sports writers. With malice aforethought, Russell once wrote, Sanders would answer questions with such moth-eaten phrases as, I hope Dame Fortune is with us. Then, after he's had his fun, Red will talk so articulately and with such a sense of what is news that he practically writes the lead paragraph. According to Russell, who continued writing his column into his 90s in the late 1990s, Sanders first uttered the winning isn't everything phrase long before he reached UCLA, indeed before he began at Vanderbilt. I remember hearing him saying it back in the mid-1930s, when he was coaching at the Columbia Military Academy, Russell recalled. It's likely that Sanders meant it literally, yet with a touch of sarcasm. 3 years after Sanders passed the phrase along to his agent, and his agent passed it along to Melville Shavelson, Sanders got in trouble at UCLA for recruiting violations. He gave a speech at a prison shortly thereafter to a group of lifers, and began by saying, Men, we've all got our problems. You are all mighty lucky you're not in the Pacific Coast Conference. How did the saying get from Sanders to Hollywood to Lombardi? It's possible that Lombardi watched trouble along the way in New York during his West Point years. His friends said that he would seek out any movie that had football in it and that he liked John Wayne. But even if he saw the movie, the phrase might not have stuck. Although his dream in 1953, when the movie came out, was to revive a dormant football program at a small Catholic college, Fordham, he would have taken issue with the dark interpretation of the movie and thus the context of the phrase. Like most aphorisms, it seems to have found its way gradually and ineluctably into the national consciousness. Before Lombardi put it on his locker room wall, it had already appeared in the yearbook of the 1961 San Diego Chargers, then coached by Sid Gilman, who decades earlier had preceded Lombardi as Colonel Blake's line coach back when MacArthur was declaring that there was no substitute for victory. Perhaps the lineage traces back through West Point. Winning isn't everything to coach Sid Gilman, the Chargers' yearbook biography began. It's the only thing. Chapter 22. It's the only thing. What do you think of that, you big fat wop? Alex Karras shouted at Lombardi. As he ran off the field at halftime of the Packers game in Detroit on October 17, 1965, with the Lions ahead by 18 points. Karras appeared to love nothing more than beating Green Bay and Lombardi. For years, the Packers had been the better team, but their games were always waged with ferocity by players as familiar with one another as brothers on opposite sides of a civil war. When Detroit had beaten Green Bay on Thanksgiving Day 1962, handing the Packers their only loss of that season, the victory nearly validated the Lions' ultimately disappointing year, and that single defeat was so distasteful in Green Bay that not even the championship win over the Giants completely erased it. Now the Packers seemed on a roll again. They had won their first four games, two of critical importance over the Colts and Bears, teams that had won the conference title the previous 2 years. The feeling was that this team didn't have the flair of the championship years, but had a more aggressive defense. In each of the first two games, Herb Adderley had returned interceptions for touchdowns, and linebacker Leroy Caffey, the Big Turkey, as Lombardi called him, who came over in the Ringo trade, scored on an interception in the third. But at halftime at Detroit, Karras had reason to roar. His Lions were ahead 21-3. They'd won three of their first four games and would be tied with Green Bay if they held the lead that afternoon. The season could turn right there. Lombardi's players were furious as they clattered into the dressing room at halftime. Surprisingly, they were more upset than their coach. Rather than vent his frustration on his players, Lombardi stepped atop a footlocker and delivered an oration on pride and loyalty. Win, lose, or